Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In February, the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, was driven from power by a wave of popular protest, that after his having been in power for 30 years. Concerns over the continuing influence of the military in Egypt and also the slow pace of reform have recently touched off new protests, and leading many to ask whether Egypt's Arab Spring was nothing more than a military coup. This time on Focus, in this hour of Focus, we'll be trying to review recent events in Egypt, and our guest is Stephen Cook. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, has written a lot about the politics of the Middle East, and in fact is the author of a recently published book. And the title of the book is The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. We're very pleased to have Stephen Cook with us as a guest to talk about recent events in Egypt. And as we do that, questions are welcome. All we ask of people is that they try to be brief, but if you want to call in, ask a question, make a comment, you can certainly do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have email. You want to send in your comment that way, you can do that as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, your questions are certainly welcome. And Stephen Cook, hello. Thanks for talking with us.
Good morning, Gabe.
Really appreciate it. Well, certainly I think a lot of people, at least people who did not follow Egyptian politics closely, were very surprised at the uprising, how quickly it gained power, and how quickly Mr. Mubarak fell. So here you are, somebody who has been following Egyptian politics for a long time. Were you surprised?
Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth. I think it wasn't just people who are casual observers of Egyptian politics or Middle Eastern politics. I think many of us who had been spending a very long time looking at Egyptian politics were equally surprised by what had happened. I remember on the first night of the uprising on January 25th, I was in Tahrir Square, and I had a number of reactions, but one of them was that this is not supposed to be happening. We are expecting political stability in the Middle East, not uprising and revolution.
Yeah. Well, and I think, though, that you, one of the points I think that you have really tried to make in talking about what has happened is to say to people, well, really, if you look at what has happened now in Egyptian politics, truly going back, maybe even going back before World War II, certainly going back to Nasser, you have to say that things were never really as stable as one might have thought. So there is a continuity, something. So there are threads that run all the way through from where we are now. They run all the way back.
That's exactly right, David. One of the major themes of this book, The Struggle for Egypt, that came out in October, is to explore the whole notion of stability or relative instability in Egypt. And one of the messages that I wanted to get across was precisely what you just articulated, that the country was never as stable as people made it out to be. It was always ideologically richer and more politically contested than what our kind of contemporary accounts are of the state versus the Muslim Brotherhood. And what I do in the book is I kind of trace this back to the inability of leaders like Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar Sadat and certainly Hosni Mubarak to answer basic questions that about Egypt in ways that made the most sense to the most Egyptians. So what kind of society did Egyptians want? What was the relationship between the citizen and the state? Or what was the relationship between religion and state? This was incredibly important, but overlooked, that these kinds of ideas that, for example, Nasserism, this group of ideas that vaguely stood for social justice, national power, a vague form of socialism, didn't actually capture the imagination of Egyptians, with perhaps the exception of a 10-year period between the 1950s and 1960s. Afterwards, the President Nasser and his leadership was very much contested. There was an uprising in 1968. Students occupied Tahrir Square, joined by labor unions and the left, to oppose Nasser's authoritarian rule. That sounds sort of familiar to what happened in January 2011. And you can trace these kinds of contested narratives from this period all the way through to the uprising. And what was nice for me, I was finishing the book at around the time of the uprising, is that it really gave it a very nice historical arc to show how this is actually something that, while not predictable, was inevitable.
Yeah. Well, you know, given that we have the last three leaders of the country, Nasser, Anwar Sadat, and Hosni Mubarak, who all made promises. They made promises about reform. They made promises about economic development. They had made promises generally to people that your lives are going to be better. And it seems that in many, many ways, for many people, those promises were never fulfilled. Now, maybe there have been important times when people have stood up and said that. But one has to ask, well, really, though, if you look at what happened here late last year and early this year, why now? I mean, was there some important precipitating event or events that really caused things to boil over?
Well, certainly, you know, the late Mubarak period was one of profound unhappiness and anger. There was a prevailing narrative among average Egyptians that the gap between rich and poor was growing, that corruption had, which had always been there, had gone out of control, that the president, President Mubarak, and importantly his wife, Suzanne Mubarak, were grooming their second son, Gamal Mubarak, to become the next president. Life for Egyptians had become harder. They felt poorer. They were not as well educated. They were falling behind. The late Mubarak period was one in which there was a sense that not only was the social contract frayed, but it had been torn asunder. And there was a number of precipitating events in the 6 months leading up to the uprising. I would point to the murder of a young man named Khalid Said in the city of Alexandria by the Egyptian police, which galvanized an opposition. Following that, there was, through the fall, a kind of crackdown in the lead-up to parliamentary elections. Those parliamentary elections were among the worst in Egypt's history of not having very good elections. In fact, you went from a parliament between 2005 and 2010 that had some semblance of an opposition to one in which there was no opposition whatsoever. And it's actually just an interesting moment to think back on. Last December, when then-President Mubarak opened the People's Assembly, there was talk about the opposition that had now been shut out of the parliament establishing their own shadow parliament that would demonstrate the differences between a democratic Egypt and the sham People's Assembly. And Mubarak departed from his prepared remarks, and in referring to this proposed idea of a shadow parliament, said, "Let them have fun," and kind of waved his hand and had a smirk on his face. And just, you know, a month later, he was driven from office. So it was this kind of arrogance of power, corruption, and it combined with a whole host of socioeconomic issues that had made Egyptians angry. But again, nobody could have predicted on January 25th, 2011, that they would succeed, that the people out in the streets would succeed in bringing down Mubarak. They had a lot of hope that they could as a result of what had happened in Tunisia. But 18 days later, when Mubarak took his flight to Sharm el-Sheikh and the military took executive power, those revolutionaries had the same kinds of reactions that the revolutionaries in Eastern and Central Europe had in the late 80s, early 1990s. They could not believe what they had achieved in such a short period of time.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a leading expert on Arab and Turkish politics. He is the author of a recent book, The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that I'm sure there are a lot of people who, when looking at what happened here, would make the argument that the role of the military here, the Egyptian military, was critical, because they looked at the way things were going, and that they decided that they needed to dump Mubarak, and that if they had stood with him, things might have been different, but they decided that he would go for them to be able to maintain their own power and their own involvement in Egypt and its economy. And that then the transition to power having come into their hands, that's the thing that I think led a lot of people to say, hey, wait a minute, what happened here? Was this a democratic revolution or was this a military coup? What sort of role did the Egyptian military play in this?
Well, it's precisely what you said. The military stepped in. First, they were concerned that had Mubarak continued and had there been real violence, I mean, almost 900 people were killed during those 18 days, but had Mubarak ordered the Ministry of Interior or privately hired thugs to really crack down, there was a fear on the part of the military that it would sow significant chaos and that it might break the military, because if you remember, almost from the very beginning, from the third day of the uprising, the military had units out on the streets, and there was concern that younger officers, captains, sergeants, majors, colonels, would not follow any orders if the order was ever given for a real crackdown. But that order was unlikely to come in the first place, because the military saw an opportunity to resolve a number of political problems that they had by essentially pushing Mubarak from office. And the chief political problem that was resolved by seeing to an end of the Mubarak rule was forever putting to bed the idea that Gamal Mubarak, the president's 40-something son, would succeed him. Gamal Mubarak, who had never served in the armed forces, who was worked for the Bank of America in London and Cairo, and who had parachuted into the top tier of the then ruling National Democratic Party, was not someone who the military had a tremendous amount of respect for. If you go back, Egypt has four presidents since the Free Officers' Coup in July 1952, and they've all been military officers. There are informal and formal connections between the military and the Egyptian presidency, and this was not something that the military seemed willing to give up. So they took advantage of this mass outpouring and demand for change to resolve this problem. But it raises a very important question. Although the military has said that it stands by the legitimate demands of the Egyptian people for a more democratic, open Egypt, and that the ruling Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has indicated since that time that it is preparing the ground for a more democratic future, you have to look at precisely what the military has done, not so much what it has said. And what it has done is worked to protect interests that it has developed over the course of the last 60 years. A vast economic empire, it being one of a tangible interest of the armed forces. In addition, the military, although not directly involved in the day-to-day governance of the country, and certainly not involved in it since the late 1960s, continued to be the source of power and authority and legitimacy in the system. They want to continue to have that kind of role. And they have just a different conception of what social cohesion and stability is from what the revolutionaries in Tahrir Square envisioned for Egypt. So if you think about it, none of those things are consistent with a more democratic and open Egypt. And that's the struggle now. The struggle between the legitimacy of a military that wants to retain certain privileges and its place in a political system and a historic place in the system versus legitimacy related to the promise of Tahrir Square, or the legitimacy that and vision of Islamist political parties who have done relatively well in the recent elections. It is by no means case closed. The military is going to have its way. What's different now in Egypt is that there is opportunity for opposition, and it is a much more contested, openly contested political environment than it was over the long period of authoritarian rule, but in particular during the Mubarak period.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it's really fascinating to watch here, because the people who did turn out in Tahrir Square and the people who were part of this movement that got rid of Mubarak, they're saying, hey, you know, we didn't do this so the military could take over. You know, that's why there's been now another wave, additional waves of protest, because people are saying, look, we mean it when we said we're expecting reform, and things are not going at the pace where they should, and the military is pushing back. So one wonders, well, how, and it may be one would have to say, look, this is what we're at here is the beginning of a long process of people in Egypt trying to figure out, as you have said, trying to figure out what kind of country do they want? What kind of government do they want? What values do they want? What's really important here? I guess I find myself wondering, well, how willing to change, to see things change, will a military be, and how patient will people be if the military is dragging its feet?
Well, I think those are the key questions in Egyptian politics now. As you point out, in the week leading up to Thanksgiving, there were the largest protests in Egypt since the fall of Mubarak. Now, the protests have never really ended. There was a two-week occupation of Tahrir Square in July. There is a hard core of the revolutionary groups who have said they will not give up street politics until the military gives up power, believing, I think quite rightly, that the military, as a residue of the old regime, is a counter-revolutionary force. But these most recent protests were sparked in part by the military's by the promulgation of a series of supra-constitutional principles that would have enshrined in the new Egyptian constitution, which is to be written in the coming months, a permanent role for the military that shielded it from the public, shielded it from the oversight of the People's Assembly, in ways that were reminiscent of Turkey during the 1980s and 1990s, which you had an autonomous military that reserved unto itself the right to end governments that it didn't like and to intervene in the political system at will. This is something that Egyptians did not want, at least those Egyptians who went out into Tahrir Square during that week. 45 of them were killed and 3,000 of them were injured in this confrontation. The military's argument is, this is not true. We are actually preparing the ground for more democratic Egypt. And the people in Tahrir Square do not represent all of Egypt. There is a great silent majority that actually supports the transition that we have set up. I think that that's right, that there are millions of Egyptians that support the military. I do think, however, that the military is miscalculating in that they believe that because there is this great silent majority out there that has turned out to vote and has not necessarily turned out into Tahrir in this most recent round, despite the large size of these protests, I don't think Egyptians want the military to recreate or salvage what it can from the Mubarak era.
Yeah. Well, I think it's true, and you can tell me if it's true, is that all around the region where there have been demands for change and reform since we started with Tunisia and then Egypt and then a number of other places, where there were people out in the streets, there were people fighting and demanding for reform, and then there were a lot of other people who, I don't know if it's necessarily they were supporting the governments, but they were afraid. They were very nervous, and what they were interested in was stability. First of all, they were also interested in and concerned about if there is change. Well, who ends up being in control after that change takes place? And it seemed that there's this really large kind of unknown element to take into consideration here. All those people who might support change to one extent or another, but were not the ones who were out in the street calling for it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, on February 11, 2011, the story is that 20 million Egyptians turned out to the streets to demand Mubarak go. I think that's an apocryphal number. I don't think there's any way of really knowing. But one of my Egypt politically active, someone who had been in Tahrir Square throughout, this is a good friend of mine, said, look, even if it was 20 million people on that day, there were 61 million other people who were not out on the streets. And I don't want to veer into a kind of explanation that, well, you know, Egyptians always want stability. They always go for stability. These are kind of old, kind of hackneyed explanations about Egyptian politics. And I don't think that they're true. I think that Egyptians have been, in one form or another, in revolt against the people who lead them or lord over them, actually, since at least 1919 and the nationalist revolution of that spring. But I think that you did have a fair number of fence sitters during the uprising in January and February. Many of those people actually, though, did join the uprising, and you did see a kind of revolutionary bandwagon in Egypt, in which the numbers got so large that it was impossible for either the military or the internal security services, which were beaten badly anyway, to control the situation. And there was really only one solution, and that was to meet the demands of the people in the streets. Now, in the subsequent 9-10 months, people have voiced concern about the trajectory of Egyptian politics, the uncertainty, the instability, the constant protest, because many Egyptians do want to get on with their lives. But like I said, there is not a strong sentiment for the military to salvage the Mubarak era, to recreate the Mubarak era best that it can.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I remember when all this started, there was some commentator whom I don't remember vaguely mentioned that the importance of the military for all this, and that there was a chance that the military may take over completely. But that mostly was drowned out because of people looking at things differently. I was wondering, is there any division within the military itself? Could there a possibility, let's put it this way, one general's group saying, well, you're not going to do this. We're going to take you guys out of here, and we're going to take control. We'd still be in military, but is there any strife within the military command itself? Thank you.
It's a very good question. And everything that we have seen and all the indications, and this is a largely closed group of people who are set off from the rest of society, but all of the indications suggest that there continues to be a unity of command within the military, and that it remains coherent in many ways. There is tremendous popular opposition to Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, who now holds executive power, but the officer, and who also is not well regarded by officers below him, but nevertheless, for the purposes of protocol and politics, they respect the chain of command. Now, anything though is possible, and the coup of 1952 was made by a bunch of junior officers who had as their front man a senior officer, someone who happened to be a general. But none of these officers were above the rank of colonel or lieutenant colonel. So what is the biggest mystery, because the senior command has been, at least since the uprising, more open to the press, to foreigners, to foreign governments than ever before. What remains the mystery is what is happening at that colonel, major, and captain level. And any time there is this kind of outpouring and protest, quite honestly, a fair amount of military bungling in handling the situation, or even handling politics on a day-to-day basis while they at least in theory temporarily hold power, there is always in the back of people's minds, well, what are those junior officers thinking? Will some unknown, unnamed new person emerge who can play a similar kind of role as Gamal Abdel Nasser did in the 1950s. Now, of course, history is not a recipe for what will happen in the future, but you can see a dynamic developing in which it would make this kind of thing possible. But as of now, there are no indications that you see a fractured military. But one of the reasons why the military has been so reluctant really to open fire on protesters or crack down or use, you know, the full brunt of its coercive power is because the senior commanders do fear fracturing the military over taking such a drastic step.
When Mubarak was still in power, he and his regime did a very good job of making sure that really there was no one got to organize much in the way of an effective opposition. The most organized opposition there was the Muslim Brotherhood, which was also illegal. And interestingly enough, they, given the fact that this was the most organized group in the uprising that toppled Mubarak, they kept a very low profile. People kept saying, "Now we need to watch them," but they kept a very low profile. And now that we've had parliamentary elections, it looks like the Muslim Brotherhood has really done very well. How do they figure into all of this?
Well, it's certainly true that the Muslim Brotherhood, which was an organization that was founded in the late 1920s, remained illegal but tolerated in a variety of important ways from the 1970s under Sadat through the Mubarak period, and that they have a kind of prestige and influence that is, I think, unrivaled by other political groups, although there were efforts on the part of other political groups and people working on the margins during the Mubarak era to advance their own political agendas. It's not as if it was just the state versus the Brotherhood. And as I said earlier, this is a richer ideological and political environment than people often make it out to be. All that being said, the Brotherhood was the most well-organized, best resourced of all of these groups. And initially, at the beginning of what became the uprising, the Brotherhood did, in fact, keep a low profile, although individual brothers, mostly on the younger end of the spectrum, did take part in the early stages of the uprising, primarily because the Brotherhood, like everybody else, thought that this was going to be yet another in a series of 1-2 day protests that had become a feature of Egyptian politics since 2003. But once it became clear that this was something altogether different and that the leadership, Mubarak's leadership, was at stake and in jeopardy, the Brotherhood did throw the full brunt of the organization into the protests. And now, 10 months later, even though the Brotherhood itself has had somewhat of a difficult time adjusting to the new environment themselves and have seen groups of them split off from the main organization and prominent members leaving the Brotherhood to pursue their own independent presidential campaigns, the Brotherhood, when it came down to it, that kind of 80-year head start, being so well organized, having resources at its disposal, and importantly, having a vision that is couched in a religious vernacular that Egyptians respond to, did very well in these elections. And the early returns suggest somewhere in the neighborhood of 40%, but when all is said and done after runoffs and the next two rounds of elections, it could be more than that.
We're talking this morning about Egyptian politics and the current events there. Our guest is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, now that Newt Gingrich is having an unexpected surge in the polls, we talk with Karen Tumulty, who's covered him for years. She's a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll look at his political career and how he became a wealthy man after he left Congress by what she describes as playing the Washington system in an entrepreneurial way. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Natural Gourmet. Natural Gourmet is a natural food store specializing in vitamin supplements, homeopathic remedies, and organic foods. Located at the Shops of Knollwood, their restaurant features Thai-influenced foods for eat-in or carry-out.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning on the show in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about some of the big challenges, financial challenges facing universities across the country, like this one. Our guest will be Howard Bunces. He's professor of accounting at Eastern Michigan University. Next week on Monday, we'll talk about some current issues in education, and our guest there will be Mary Kalantzis. She's dean of the College of Education at the University of Illinois. Also, we'll have an opportunity for you to ask healthcare questions. This is something that we do every other month. It's a program we just call Talk to the Family Doctor because that's who the guest is, Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. So if you have questions about the health of yourself, your family, you can call in on Monday. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. Also, you can listen to past programs that way. The guest in this hour of Focus is Stephen Cook. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a leading expert on Arab and Turkish politics, and he is the author of a recently published book, which is titled The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square. It's published by the Oxford University Press, in which he tries to take a look at Egyptian history now going back to the time of Nasser, and really makes the argument that you can put what has been going on now over the last few months in Egypt into that context of Egyptian history, and you can in fact see that there is continuity that goes certainly back to before World War II. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to step aside from Egyptian politics for a moment and talk about American politics, and at the risk of, you know, the criticism that we too often look at things through our own lens, it is true that the United States has regarded Egypt as being a very important ally in the region, and I think you've argued that actually, as far as the Egyptians were concerned, that wasn't always a good thing. People often looked at their own government, Egyptian people looked at their own government and saw it as somehow being weakened by its association with the United States. So are there people in Egypt who see this as an opportunity to reassess the relationship between Egypt and the United States? And are we likely to see some change there?
I think no doubt there is... powerful political forces, not just parties, but just politics, that is going to drive a divergence from the United States after a 30-year strategic relationship. The Brotherhood, which, as we just pointed out, has done very well, at least in the first round of the election, is likely to do well in the subsequent rounds, believed through a notional party platform that they put out in 2007, and their most recent electoral platform from 2010 stated clearly that the relationship with the United States had rendered Egypt a secondary or second-rate power, that it had at one time been the region's leading power, but that when Sadat decided to reorient Egyptian foreign policy towards the United States, that the strategic relationship had served American interests but not necessarily Egyptian interests. And I think that is not a sentiment that is restricted to the Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters. If you look at secular, liberal, younger, revolutionary groups and the new political parties that have emerged since the uprising, the vast majority of them look at the relationship between Egypt and the United States with suspicion, given Washington's long history of supporting Mubarak, and now Washington's continued relationship with the people who hold executive authority in Egypt, the military, which people are distrustful of. So I think that it is likely to change. I don't think that there's going to be a breach in the relationship, but I think Egyptians are looking to have a more independent foreign policy, and that if they have a more independent foreign policy that is and demonstrates to the region and the world that Egypt is willing to defy the United States on important issues, that Egypt will regain its lost regional luster. And you already see indications of this in a new kind of relationship between the interim Egyptian government and Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement in Gaza. You see it in Egyptian discussion of establishing diplomatic relations with Iran. You see it in Egypt's posture towards Israel writ large. So I think that this is coming. It's slow because the present government really is an interim government, and because the military is tied to the United States through aid. But I think ultimately we are going to see distance between Washington and Cairo. And I think actually, though, in the long run, it may be a healthy bit of distance, because if Egypt can establish a leading role in the region again, it may be a more appropriate interlocutor for the United States and the Arab world than Mubarak's Egypt, which was hopelessly compromised by the perception that he was just a lackey of the United States.
Mm. So if a more independent, an Egypt that is seen as more independent would have more credibility with other governments in the region, and that they're as long as they were pursuing the kind of policies that we would like to see, that in the long run, that would actually be better for the United States.
Well, you know, just to give you an example of what Egyptians would like to see out of their government, and what the more kinds of things that you will see. If you remember back to the spring of 2010 and this incident off the coast of Gaza between the Israeli defense forces and this Turkish ferry, the Mavi Marmara, and in the aftermath of that unfortunate incident, the Turkish prime minister and foreign minister took the Israelis to task in from their perspective of a principled kind of way. At the time, the Egyptian opposition was stunned. Why didn't the Egyptian government take these kinds of positions? And the reason was that the Egyptian government was colluding with the Israelis in the blockade of the Gaza Strip. And so I think that you will see these kinds of changes, and you will see the Egyptian government taking a more independent stand. And the theory, at least in Cairo, is that this will refurbish Egypt's once leading role in the region.
Mm. Just back to talking about what the results have been in the recent elections there. As you explain, we talked about the Muslim Brotherhood doing well. We're also reading about other Islamist parties that are even more, let us say, more conservative than the Brotherhood is. And again, I'm sure people watching from outside, there's always this concern, well, what exactly does that mean? If we have Islamist parties essentially being the dominant parties in government, or, you know, what in terms of their policy, in terms of their relationship with the United States, what exactly does that mean?
Well, there is another Islamist party that has, prior to the runoffs, the estimate was that it would get anywhere between 20 to 25% of the vote in the first round of the election. This is the Al-Nur party. And the Al-Nur party comes from a different kind of tradition and worldview than the Muslim Brotherhood. They are Salafists who prescribe to a literal interpretation of the Quran and the Sunnah, Islamic law. And whereas the Brotherhood has a relatively more liberal, without it being liberal, worldview, the Salafists are, you know, for making it, you know, simplifying things a little bit, it takes a more hardline view on the role of the Egypt's Christian minority in the political and social life of the country. It takes a harder line view on the application of Islamic law in Egypt, although it's important to point out that the Brotherhood itself has never repudiated the establishment of Islamic State with Sharia as its basis. But they have a different interpretation from the Salafis on this issue. So the fear has been, obviously, that these people, both the Brotherhood and the Salafis, don't obviously share a worldview with their more liberal, secular, cosmopolitan neighbors, Egyptian neighbors, and that from the perspective of the United States, this can, if their influence is felt in the actual governing of the country and ruling of the country and formulating policy, that this would be a blow to U.S. policy in the region. I think that a lot of the fears about an Islamist bloc of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist Ennahda party hooking up and kind of running the table in Egyptian politics is a bit overblown. First of all, I think that, again, even though you can extrapolate a good part of these results from the first round to the subsequent two rounds, I think with runoffs, the Ennahda's results are probably going to be less than the 20-25%. Predicted, but certainly more than the single digits than prior to the elections the polling was suggesting. And I think also you will see that the Brotherhood, because they have this different worldview and because the Brotherhood is less a religious organization than it is actually a political organization, that advances its political agenda through a kind of religious lens or religious vernacular, but really is a political organization, that they will, because politics demands it, make common cause with more liberal groups in the parliament, and at times make common cause with the Salafists, as their interests dictate. Politics isn't new to Egyptians. Under that kind of level of national politics, there was there were syndicates, there were other zones of politics where Egyptians became used to this kind of thing, and there's precedent for the Brotherhood making common cause with groups that you wouldn't think that it would for political advantage or because its immediate interests demand it. So I'm not quite as concerned that this is going to be, you know, the end and that Egypt is going to become some sort of theocracy. I certainly think you'll see the advancement of, you know, Islamization, and that is already – that proceeded quite far under Sadat and Mubarak. You will see further expressions of that, but I'm not sure that Egypt is going to become a hostile theocracy in the Middle East.
We have 7-8 minutes left again in this hour of focus. Our guest is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has written a lot about Arab and Turkish politics, including a recent book, The Struggle for Egypt, From Nasser to Tahrir Square, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. And certainly we are open here to questions, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email is also possible. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. There will, at some point, there'll be a presidential election. What sort of power does the president have? And when Egyptians get around to casting votes for president, will that be, how significant will that be?
Well, under the present constitution, the Egyptian president has a tremendous amount of both formal and informal power. I mean, the informal doesn't flow from the constitution, but it flows from other things, but certainly a tremendous amount of power. In fact, the focal point of Egyptian politics, and to the extent that Egyptians often referred offhandedly to Mubarak and even Sadat before him as the Pharaoh, not an admiring kind of way. The presidential election is slated to happen sometime in the spring. Originally, the military was thinking about a handover to a president, a full civilianization of government in the first quarter of 2013, but as a result of those big protests in Tahrir Square at the end of November, they moved that up to June, July 2012. So we have a very busy Egyptian political season. We have the lower house of parliament elections, then we have the upper house, then we're supposed to have constitution writing, and then we're supposed to have a presidential election. I don't think any of these things are going to happen on time, but I think the tendency will be, at least among those who are either come from the parliament or the outside to be part of a committee of 100 to draft a new constitution, is to reduce the power of the president. Now, the military has said that it won't be directly involved in the writing of the constitution, but it will be involved. And I think a weaker president is certainly not in the interest of the armed forces, because that has been the connection between the main connection between the military and the political system. So I think that this is going to be a big fight going forward. What is in the Constitution, the relationship between the parliament and the military, and importantly, what powers the new constitution will endow upon a new president. The as I said, the tendency, the inclination is going to be on the part of civilians, activists, democratic activists, to reduce the power of the president, whereas you have powerful forces working in the other direction to continue to see a rather strong executive.
Is it too soon to talk about who might be leading contender?
Well, there are a number of declared and undeclared presidential candidates, and their viability waxes and wanes really with the news cycle. But there are some who are clearly familiar to your listeners, people like Mohamed El-Baradei, who was the Secretary General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which clashed with the Bush administration in the run-up to the Iraq War, who El-Baradei, after leaving the IAEA, has returned to Egypt to be a leader of the opposition and is favored by a kind of certain upper-crust liberal group, but doesn't really command a huge following. There's Amr Moussa, the former Egyptian foreign minister, who is the Secretary General of the Arab League, who over the course of the last decade has distanced himself from Mubarak and sees himself as a real contender for the presidency. Then you have someone like Abdelmenem Abu Fatou, who's a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood, who fashions himself as the Egyptian version of Tayyip Erdogan, the very charismatic prime minister of Turkey, who's been extraordinarily successful over the course of the last decade, transforming the Turkish political system and the Turkish economy. You have other candidates, a judge by the name of Hisham Bastawisi, who was came into public view in 2006 when the regime was cracking down on the judiciary. So you have and other Islamist candidates as well. So you have a real spectrum here. The question is, just like in our primary, there's no formal primary in Egypt, but just like what we're seeing unfold here, who will be the last man standing? And I think it's really anybody's guess right now who's going to be a real contender.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about how over time there has been this long unsatisfied desire for change and for reform in the country, and that over three different governments or three different rulers, there were promises made that a lot of people felt weren't fulfilled. So, but having said that, do you think that among the people of Egypt, really, that there is much in the way of consensus about what it is they want and what kind of country they would want Egypt to be?
I don't think that there's consensus at all. And one of the reasons why I called my book The Struggle for Egypt is because I don't think, of course, when I started writing it, I didn't know that there was going to be this uprising and this change. But I don't think that until those kind of antecedent questions about what kind of society they want, what's the relationship between citizen and state, relationship between religion and state, until those questions are answered in a way that makes sense to a lot of Egyptians, I think that this kind of struggle will continue. You'll see a lot of uncertainty. You will see a lot of instability. You will see periods marked by flare-ups of violence. And the danger there is that someone will seek authoritarian solutions to these problems, and we will be back to square one. I mean, one of the clear problems in Egyptian politics is that neither Nasser nor Sadat nor Mubarak, who never even really tried, were able to have a kind of positive myth about Egypt and the trajectory of Egyptian society and politics that elicited the loyalty of people, the vast majority of Egyptians. So they were forced; these leaders were forced to rely on the coercion of the police and ultimately the military. That's a pretty risky place to be, as we've seen in the case of Mubarak most recently. But nevertheless, as this uncertain and unstable period continues, because Egyptians are unable to answer these questions in a satisfactory way, there are likely to be politicians or political entrepreneurs out there who will seek authoritarian solutions like Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak did. I think the one real kind of silver lining in all this is that Egyptians are engaged in a very serious debate about these questions, about what Egyptian society stands for, what kind of society they want. It's happening up and down the country, across the socioeconomic scale, and across the political spectrum. And it's happening at various degrees of sophistication, but it's happening. And that's very, very important, because although these questions and these debates have been going on for a very long time, this is the first time in at least 60 years, but before, where it is happening in a relatively freer political environment. And I think that that's very important.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that we just have about a minute or so left, but I'm sure that there was, that there among Egyptian people, there was a tremendous feeling of, well, maybe surprise, maybe amazement. Maybe they were a little stunned at what they had actually had achieved, but also a real feeling of pride that they did indeed achieve something that had never happened before. And you know, one wonders how long that can be maintained, and if somebody can come along and really harness that, they could go a long way with that.
My temptation to say to you is that the struggle for Egypt continues, but I think there's a real insight here. You know, Mubarak, who they called a pharaoh, you don't drive a pharaoh from power, you build a pyramid to his memory. The fact that they were able to bring down Mubarak has created this moment of empowerment. I mean, one of the things that people were chanting in Tahrir Square was hold up your head. This is a moment of national dignity, and there is an opportunity for politicians to take up this moment, but in a positive way. But there's obviously also an opportunity for people to harness this kind of national dignity and empowerment in a host of negative ways. My hope is for the former.
Well, I think we're about at the point here where we have to finish up and to say thanks to our guest, Stephen Cook. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a leading expert on Arab and Turkish politics. If you'd like to read more about recent Egyptian history, or maybe not totally recent, you can look for the book that we have talked about. It's The Struggle for Egypt from Nasser to Tahrir Square. It's recently published by Oxford University Press. Stephen, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, Dave.